From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty with the news on this day in Maine,
Wednesday, July 24th, 2019.
The Maine Attorney General and AGs in 11 other states are calling on the Trump administration to end its rollback of mileage standards. Maine Attorney General Aaron Fry says the Trump administration's decision-making fails to take into account states like Maine that have worked to establish stringent vehicle emission standards. The Maine Center for Disease Control has confirmed another case of the tick-borne Powassan virus. Health officials say the adult is hospitalized in New Hampshire, but the virus is believed to have been contracted in Maine. Symptoms can include fever, headache, vomiting, and weakness. Although Powassan is rare, it can be life-threatening. To reduce exposure to tick bites, the CDC recommends wearing long sleeves and pants, using insect repellent, and avoiding high grass or bushy areas. And the CEO of the Westbrook-based company IDEX Laboratories announced today that he sustained a severe spinal cord injury in a cycling accident last month. John Ayers is expected to be in rehab for 3 to 5 months. Patty White has details.
Ayers made the announcement through a statement posted to the company's website. He says the accident happened during his regular group morning ride on June 27th. Ayers says he has limited arm and wrist movement and no mobility or sensory in his hands, torso, and legs. He's currently being treated at what he describes as a world-class rehabilitation center, where he hopes to regain some neuromuscular capability. A spokeswoman from IDEX declined to provide comment beyond Ayers' statement. The executive director of the Bicycle Coalition of Maine, John Williams, says Ayers is a strong supporter of the cycling community and an enthusiastic rider.
Keith's told me stories of getting up in Portland in the morning and riding out to Mount Washington and back all in the same day. It's pretty incredible. He loves riding, and I hope that he'll be able to get back to it at some point. But we're very, very sorry to hear the news.
While Ayers undergoes rehabilitation, he says he remains in close contact with senior management, including interim CEO Jay Mazelski. IDEX is a veterinary and water quality diagnostics company that employs nearly 3,000 people in Maine and more than 8,000 worldwide. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
And in weather tonight, mostly clear skies with lows in the high 40s and 50s. Tomorrow, partly cloudy skies with highs in the 70s to low 80s, and on Friday, partly sunny and more humid. Officials in the city of Portland are racing to find housing for migrant families who unexpectedly arrived here after a long, dangerous journey through the U.S.-Mexico border last month. But as the August 15th deadline approaches to close the emergency shelter that is currently housing the families, city officials say some migrants are turning down housing in other communities. And now some on the Portland City Council say Mayor Ethan Strimling is spreading misinformation and giving anxious families false hopes that they can stay. The mayor says such claims are pure election year politics. Steve Missler has our story.
The migrant families, mostly from the Democratic Republic of Congo and Angola, arrived in Portland on buses last month and have been staying in a basketball gymnasium at the Portland Expo ever since. Contractual obligations will close the Expo shelter in mid-August, and that's forced city officials to find housing for approximately 150 families in towns like Brunswick, Bath, and Gorham. But the city's Health and Human Services Director, Kristen Dow, told the city council Tuesday night that families are turning down housing outside of Portland, even though the state is helping with rent and other necessities.
It's really frustrating and upsetting for staff to work this hard to house these families, to have them turned down over and over and over again.
Dow's remarks to the city council largely echoed an email she sent last week to city manager John Jennings. But in that email, which was provided to Maine Public Radio, Dow added that city staff, quote, simply can't compete with a counter message from Mayor Ethan Strimling. The nature of Strimling's discussions with the migrant families he's met with dominated Tuesday's meeting, putting the mayor on the defensive as he forcefully denied that he's played any part in families' decisions to deny housing assignments outside of Portland. Strimling told the council that some migrants were anxious about moving out of the city, a move that puts them farther away from critical resources and requires address changes to make sure immigration and court documents don't get lost, which could jeopardize their asylum cases.
So when I said to them, of course you have a say, of course, Nobody can force you to live anywhere that you don't want to live. But understand that if you choose not to go there, you may be living in a shelter for a long time, or you may be on the streets. That is a true statement.
But several councilors, including his re-election opponent, Spencer Thibodeau, accused the mayor of sending mixed messages that could have dire consequences for families who don't take housing assignments outside of the city. That's because the council has backed a policy that says anyone who refuses a housing offer made by their caseworker can no longer stay at the shelter. Thibodeau says not making that outcome clear poses a real risk to the migrant families, who could end up at an overflow facility that is only open at night and provides no meals or medical care.
Because when you give any sort of equivocation on what is going to happen, people believe that their best option is what they know. That's why when we say something, we have to be clear about it.
Strimling denies that his message to migrant families wasn't clear and says his intent was to explain that the families could return to Portland later if they wanted or could afford housing there. But Councillor Belinda Ray, who recently dropped her bid to challenge Strimling this fall, described the mayor's actions as reckless and worthy of censure.
Policies have been misconstrued to people in a way that puts them in peril, and I am not comfortable having someone speak for the city who cannot speak correctly on city policies.
Ray's assertion stemmed in part from an email written by a shelter worker last week that chronicled a meeting between Strimling, Councillor Pius Ali, and several migrant families. The shelter worker, who was doubling as a translator during Strimling's meeting, described the mayor as questioning the city policy, adding that no one will be asked to leave and, quote, that no one should be forced to live in a place he does not want. But the worker's email also confirmed part of Strimling's assertion, that he told the families they may have to leave Portland but could potentially come back. Councillor Pius Ali also backed Strimling's account during Tuesday's meeting, but the subsequent chain of email responses last week from city officials blame the mayor for spreading misinformation. Again, Strimling stood his ground, telling the council it knew families were refusing housing assignments long before his conversation with them was documented by the interpreter.
Might you remember that the night before, that night actually before I went down to the shelter, the city manager came and talked to us and said, there's already a problem where people are saying they don't want to take the housing.
On Wednesday, Strimling told Maine Public Radio that his opponents on the council were using the migrant families as political pawns and the controversy to mar his re-election bid. And he also questioned the origin of a city policy that could soon impact dozens of migrant families if they refuse housing assignments. Maine Public Radio has requested a copy of the policy, but city officials were unable to provide any additional information by airtime. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
In October of 2015, a forest surveyor working in federal land in western Maine made a disturbing discovery. The surveyor stumbled across what turned out to be the campsite and the skeletal remains of Geraldine Largay. Largay, who was 66, had gone missing 2 years before, and her body was found surprisingly close to the trail. In his new book, When You Find My Body, Maine author Dee Dauphiné explores what happened to Largay in the last days of her life and how someone could become so irrevocably lost so close to the trail.
A lot of people that hike the Appalachian Trail, they can prepare a lot of different ways, and they can set one foot in front of the other, and they do a good job on the Appalachian Trail or on any long-distance hike, but a lot of them don't have any woodscraft or knowledge of what to do if they get lost. And having been involved in search and rescue in the old days, I can tell you the stressors of getting lost are enormous and can cause a lot of different problems physiologically, physically, mentally. And so once she got lost and she lost her bearings, it didn't take very long for her to make some poor decisions.
We heard a lot about her when she was originally lost and then when her body was found. And she was an interesting person. Who was Geraldine Largay?
She had raised her family in the suburbs of Nashville, Tennessee, had after the family was grown, they moved to the Atlanta area, and she was involved in many things, the Nature Conservancy and the Alpharetta Newcomers Club, where they did everything from quilting and hiking to bridge. And she was involved in many parts of that community. She was very spiritual, let's say religious person. She converted to Catholicism because her husband George was a Catholic and involved in the church. And she wrote in her journals that she prayed, and she told people that she hiked along the trails, that she prayed a lot. And so all these things came together to paint a pretty clear picture of what kind of person she was. Gregarious, spiritual, engaging, a lovely person that was in love with nature.
You did some research yourself on the circumstances of Geraldine Largay's death, and specifically her physical state before she died. What did you find?
Physically, everything was intact. As we said, that she didn't really know what to do to aid in her self-rescue. She had remembered from her Girl Scout days to stay put, but she didn't. She wandered around, by her own reckoning, about 4 miles the first day, kind of paralleling the Appalachian Trail, walking the wrong direction. She ended up trying to climb higher and higher to find cell phone service instead of staying put, and crossed several brooks and kept climbing higher and higher. But there's no cell phone service for even miles in that area. So once she decided she'd kind of had enough and worn herself down on the second day, she did stay put, but by then had dug herself so far into the forest that in such terrible, terrible terrain that searchers just couldn't find her. It was really difficult because, you know, some places there you can't see 10 feet and you can't hear somebody screaming or blowing a whistle from 60 yards away.
What do we take from this story?
Well, you know, that's part of the early research. I knew there were obvious lessons about maybe learning map and compass work and carrying one on the Appalachian Trail or any long-distance hike where you might be going through the wilderness. But beyond that, there was lessons about our reliance on technology in the backcountry, which isn't a great thing to do because sometimes those technologies aren't going to help you, or devices. In addition, I spoke to the trail culture on the Appalachian Trail. You know, the trail is so well marked that the Appalachian Trail culture and hikers, many of them insist that you don't need map and compass or any of the wilderness survival skills, that the trail is so well marked that it's just not necessary. So I really spoke to that in the book, and I wasn't sure how the Appalachian Trail community was going to respond to that, but overwhelmingly it's been great. I've had several hundred emails from people that have read the book that said, you know, I'm taking a course, I went and bought a compass, and things like that. So I think part of the, you know, Jerry was such a caregiver that I think that I trusted that were she alive, she'd be happy to know, you know, whatever she did on the Appalachian Trail would contribute to somebody's safety down the road potentially.
Dee Dauphiné is a writer and backcountry guide based in Bradley, Maine. His new book is When You Find My Body, The Disappearance of Geraldine Largay on the Appalachian Trail. Dee, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org and join us tomorrow on Maine Calling at 1 o'clock, where a panel of experts on gardening will take calls. I'm Nora Flaherty.